Therefore, the Lord himself will give you a sign. Look, the young woman is with child and shall bear a son and shall name him Emmanuel. Isaiah 7:14.
You're listening to By the Well, a weekly podcast for preachers where we delve into the lectionary readings to help you preach this Sunday. Please subscribe to us wherever you listen to podcasts. I'm Robin Whittaker.
And I'm Fran Barber. And today we're joined by the Reverend Rachel Kronberger, who is minister at Yarraville Uniting Church in Melbourne. Welcome, Rachel.
Thanks, Fran. Thanks, Robin. It's good to be here.
Great to have you here. We're talking today about the Advent 4 readings for Year A, with a focus on Isaiah 7:10 to 16 and Matthew 1:18 to 25. But let's perhaps start with Isaiah and that very famous verse we just heard you read, Rachel, about this young woman who'll bear a child. She's not the only young woman, or in fact really old woman, in the Hebrew Bible who has a sort of fairly unexpected birth. So how do we hear this with the wider echo of Scripture going on?
Thanks, Robin. Well, one of the things we see with the miraculous pregnancies in the Hebrew Scriptures is that women like Sarah are too old to have a child when they have a miraculous conception. Women like Hannah and Rachel spend years trying to conceive and experience those years as humiliating and traumatic. And so the miraculous conception, while within reasonable childbearing years, is hugely significant because they've been proven to be unable to have children. What Isaiah says here is that a young woman will conceive, that the Lord will act into a pregnancy with a young woman, not with an older woman or a woman who's already been demonstrated to be unable to have children.
And we don't get her name here, unlike some of the other women you've just named, whose stories we know a bit more about. In fact, the text calls her a sign. It's hard to know if she's even a real woman in some ways. Is she simply a symbol of something greater? How do we interpret what's going on here?
I think the sign here is not just the young woman, but this moment of her pregnancy and her birth giving of the child who will be called God with us, Emmanuel. And so this is a moment when God will speak through a child, through a pregnancy and a child, into a community that is currently deeply troubled.
And there's so many questions here, isn't there? And I want to pick up on just that last comment you made. This chapter starts with a context of political rivalry and impending war. We've got two neighbouring kings, King Rezin of Aram, which is Syria, and King Pekah, who have formed an alliance to really wage war on King Ahaz and on the Judean people, on Jerusalem. And the text is quite vivid in the way it talks about that. It talks about the people shaking like leaves on a tree. There's real terror at the kind of conflict or destruction that might come. And it's out of that this sign is promised. And I love the imagery in verse 11. It's the sign, let it be as deep as Sheol, which is a word for Hades or the underworld, and it's as high as the heaven. This is like an all-encompassing sign of really new life in the midst of impending destruction. But, of course, the church has got rather tied up in the historical details of this young woman and what it means around virginity in the later tradition.
Yeah, I think people do get a bit caught up with the impossibility in scientific or historical terms for how a virgin can have a child.
Mm.
And I'm very struck by Ben Myers' writing on this in this area in his book, The Apostles' Creed. And he says, when people, for example, stand up to say the creed, very often there's silence in that line about...
Which is the line you're referring to? The virgin can... We should all remember the Apostles' Creed, shouldn't we?
conceived by the Holy Spirit, born of the Virgin Mary. Conceived by the Holy Spirit, born of the Virgin Mary. And there's silence because, Ben says that we really need to see this wider context of the Hebrew people and of the scriptures and to understand what Matthew or what Isaiah is doing with this tradition and then what Matthew does with it. And Ben has a very good analogy, I think. He says, imagine you'd never seen a bicycle and on the floor you saw what we all know to be a bicycle chain. You'd never seen it before. What is it? Is it a weapon? Is it a necklace? Mm. Is it some piece of machinery? And that in a way for us to pick out the virgin birth and pull it apart scientifically and historically, we're essentially trying to do the impossible and we're not seeing the wider context. And Ben himself talks about it somewhat flippantly, but not entirely, that you could understand the Bible as a series of miraculous births. And this is the way God breaks into human history and suffering and violence with a word of new creation and of hope and of ongoing life when it feels totally impossible for the people in the predicament at the time.
And we know in families so often, I mean, this is an incredibly human and grounded image, isn't it? That a baby, it's something a lot of people can relate to. We've been babies, we've met babies, even if we haven't had babies. This is just a very human image of the way that life keeps coming, even in the midst of death and destruction.
It's also a very intimate image. If you have had a baby, then you do know what that is, an extremely close connection sort of with another being. And for God to want to intervene with his people in this way is a deeply intimate act or way of conceiving it.
That's right.
I think part of the way that Matthew uses the quote from Isaiah and is to draw us into the story with this claim of the virgin conception. And for Matthew's communities, for a Jewish community to hear a story of a miraculous conception is a sign to them that God is present in this story.
Yeah.
And even for Matthew's Greek listeners, it's something that they know from Greek traditions about this is a divine human interaction.
That's right.
That's going on. So it's a detail that's designed to draw us into the story, but in our culture it pushes us away either because of the church claiming that if you don't believe in the virgin birth as an historical event, that you have no place in the church, or by saying, it's not necessary to believe in the virgin birth, come to church anyway, nobody believes it anyway. There's a sort of, we use it as a point of pushing away rather than accepting Matthew's invitation to be drawn in by this detail.
Yeah, Rachel, and I also think people forget that this is not a biography in any obvious way, and that the writer of Matthew was writing after encounters with Jesus or stories of people's transformative encounter with Jesus, and were writing his story saying this person must have come in an unprecedented way, but in a way that is recognizable by our tradition.
That's right.
And so that it's post-resurrection writing here, not saying this is exactly what happened in the sort of simplistic linear way that we understand the world, but that this is a post-resurrection.
And although Luke and Matthew agree on very little in their infancy narratives, this is one detail they both have, and most scholars, I'll defer to you, Robin, on this one, most scholars understand them to have been working independently. So they've each received this tradition of the virgin.
That's right. And Matthew tells us the sort of, what we might refer to as the male side of the story, which is Joseph's reaction and Joseph's encounter with the angel, whereas Luke will give us all those women's stories of Mary's encounter with the angel. It's worth just noting a few things too for our listeners that in the original Hebrew of Isaiah 7, the word there is really a word for young woman, an alma, a maiden, someone of marriageable age. It's not it doesn't bear the weight of the technicality that we've, you know, invested in it later on. In the Hebrew Bible, it is often used to refer to virgins, to unmarried, pre-married young women. But there's a couple of times it's used where it's very clear it's not a virgin. So in Joel 1, this word is used to describe a young woman and it then refers to her husband. So it includes that meaning, but it's not limited to that meaning. And then, of course, Matthew's using the Greek here and he picks up this parthenos word, which again has a broader range of meanings than just this technical virginity that, as you say, Rachel, we've used to kind of almost be a line in the sand of, do you accept this, what seems to our modern scientific minds to be an implausible thing? And we've got rather hung up on the wrong point of the story.
Yes.
I liked what one of you just said before about, you know, like for Matthew's framing of this, this is a way of talking about the presence of God. And the other really important word here is, of course, that Emmanuel word.
Yes.
What do we do with that? What's captured in that term?
Well, Robin, my first response to that is that God Emmanuel is what we're preaching and praying and giving thanks for.
Mm-hmm.
Well, actually, 52 Sundays of the year.
Yes, not but, just at Christmas.
Much as every Sunday is Resurrection Day too. But in Advent in particular, this is a particular focus each week of Advent. And I guess this week is a particular focus on how Isaiah uses it and what Matthew does with it. What would you say, Rachel, about Matthew's particular focus on Emmanuel, God with us?
I think Matthew wants us to understand that this person of Jesus, whose story he is telling here, represents something of enormous significance in terms of God's relationship with the whole of humanity. And we see, you know, in the Isaiah passage that that we referred to earlier, and Robin's comment about the promise being from the depths of Sheol to the highest heaven. This is about the whole creation.
Cosmic.
It's a cosmic event. Mm. And so I think God is with us in this child. Presumably Joseph had some familiarity with the scriptures, and so it's a word of reassurance to him that God is present in his apparently disastrous life moment.
Yes, where he's probably wondering what's going on with his marriage and his betrothed, and
that's right. And there's a whole lot of things we could say about the complexity for Joseph's
reputation
in this moment. Yes. Well, really, he's in choosing to stick by Mary, he hangs his own family out to dry. You know, he's
potentially bringing shame on them.
Brings shame on them because he has this, you know, adulterous fiance or wife in
what dubious one. Yeah, that there'll be questions about.
Yeah, there'll be a lot of questions about. Do you know? Is it one of Toni Morrison's books where the women watch over the fence to see where the menstrual rags are on the clothesline, and when they notice them missing, you know, they start rumours about the young women in the house next door. You know, you can kind of imagine what sort of tensions are at play in this very communal society for Joseph. So it's no small thing for God, for the angel to say, in this child God will be
with
present,
you.
Will be with not just with both with you and with the whole of creation.
Mm. I think that's the challenge when we preach these texts, is to do that kind of both and of what Sam Wells, who's a priest scholar in England, talks about, the epic and the lyric, which is we've got to hold together the broad pattern of biblical traditions and the way that, you know, throughout those thousands of years that the biblical stories cover, God intervenes in this kind of way, and that, you know, God's new life is seen in these miracles and things. With the deeply personal, that for Joseph there was a huge amount at stake. This is real, it's personal, it's intimate. And I find that a challenge, to be honest, when I preach, of how we talk about, there's something about God with us here that is cosmic. It's about God with the world, God that transforms the world through Jesus. But then also what that does for us about God transforming our own personal lives and our immediate contexts through Jesus.
Yes. And we, you know, few stories of conception and birth, even in our time, are entirely straightforward. You know, we will each have people in our congregations, if not ourselves as preachers, who have stories of, you know, difficulties in conceiving, stories of health issues that prevented childbearing, of tragic loss of children, of miscarriages, of children who were born and people said, you know, well, they left it a bit late, or they started too young, or they, you know, didn't, they weren't ready, they hadn't even bought a house yet. You know, that, all the things that people say. Everyone, I think, has heard some word of judgment about their own circumstance, and there's a word of comfort here, I think, for all of us that, you know, God is with us, and children are a sign of blessing and hope and to be treasured.
Yep. Let me push you on that, because I always feel like there's a pastoral, a potential pastoral issue when we preach these texts, because we want to acknowledge that God is with us and that these, you know, new life, children are a blessing from God, all of what you've just said, except I'm conscious there could also be a woman or a couple sitting in the pew who are in the midst of deep grief about being unable to have children.
And how is God with them? You know, that's the question that would possibly be haunting them.
Yeah, so how do we address that in our preaching in a way that, you know, we're honouring the story and the God, the way God is claimed to work in this Isaiah story that Matthew picks up and uses to more particularly point to Jesus. But how do we capture the essence of that in a way that isn't going to leave that woman or that couple feeling maybe God's not with me then?
Well, Joseph and Mary's situation isn't really commented on here in Matthew, but for Joseph, you know, this is really a tough situation, and the fact of the pregnancy is the problem for him. So the affirmation of the angel is that God, in this moment of difficulty for him, in this moment of potential suffering, of humiliation, of isolation perhaps from his family and community, that God is with him, is faithfully with him. And, you know, the angel, I love the angel in this, just like the Annunciation to Mary and Luke, the angel says, do not be afraid.
Yes.
You know, God is with you. And I think for Joseph, the difficult situation was the pregnancy. For others, the difficult situation might be the lack of pregnancy.
Yeah,
Or the death of a child, or you know, some other really difficult situation. And in all of these things, we hear the voice of the angel saying, do not be afraid,
And God is with us.
Yeah.
Yep. And Matthew really presses that, because he's quoting from the Greek translation of the Old Testament, the Septuagint, and Emmanuel is a Hebrew term, and, you know, in this case turned into a name. So he actually is at pains. He adds to what is not there in the original Isaiah quote and says, which means God is with us. He wants his Greek readers to understand what the word Emmanuel means.
Yes.
You know, so he's really pressing on that. This is about God's presence and God's blessing, even when it might not feel like that.
And I don't think that can be overstated in Advent.
No, that's true. So there's your preaching theme. Hammer that one home.
And it's also, just to go back to the lyric, to the epic, rather than the, in that it's not just in our personal, painful personal lives perhaps, but the world around us, it is abundantly clear in many situations that God does not appear to be with us. So that pastoral question can be broadened in a way that speaks to everybody and acknowledges that there is pain, and that, but nevertheless, God is with us. And I was talking to a minister this week who's very experienced, and he talked about the nevertheless is always there in the gospel, the word nevertheless. The narrative of life looks like this. It does look like this, and it's not denial to say, but nevertheless, God is there.
Yes.
And I mean, you know, again, that's probably what we're doing every Sunday or every day. But.
Yeah, that's right.
And back to the lyric, I guess.
Yes.
There's something that I think we need to notice about Joseph in this story, which is that Joseph has this obligation to do, or this opportunity to use the law to his own advantage.
Yes.
And he doesn't. He makes a choice that is merciful and just and righteous, and engages with the law in a way that is very bountiful in terms of its love and compassion and respect.
It's generous.
Not legalistic.
Not legalistic, but incredibly generous. And through Matthew's gospel, we see Jesus demonstrating over and over that it is continuous with the law to come to the law with a heart full of compassion and justice. And I can't help feeling that he got that from Joseph. You know, that there's a there's a sense of Joseph demonstrating, it's not just there's Matthew's literary kind of strategy of introducing a gospel theme here in Joseph's behaviour, but there's also this beautiful human moment of a father teaching a son something really profound.
Robin, I was going to ask something about that, well, both of you, but Robin in particular. When you're preaching as a Christian preacher and you're talking about the law in that way, but Joseph applied the law in a compassionate way, I'm just wondering whether there are implications in how we do that for our relationship with our Jewish brothers and sisters. That might be a bit too big a question for this.
No, it's a really important question. And it's probably one we'll revisit throughout this year, particularly with the year of Matthew, because as Rachel said, there's a lot of discussion of the law in Matthew. Matthew is often thought of quite a Jewish feeling gospel. He portrays Jesus as a kind of new Moses, so very much in that Torah instruction tradition. I mean, I think the first thing to acknowledge, in the way that Rachel just did, actually, is that within the framework of the law was the possibility to make gracious and merciful judgments. The law wasn't, and I don't even like the word law for Torah. I think of it more as instruction or way of life, that it was a way of living that allowed you to embody the values of God. But I do think it means for Christian preachers we need to really resist the temptation to paint the Jews around Jesus as somehow legalistic and Jesus as somehow the exception, because he's a Jew who's interpreting the law. And so he's actually modelling, like Joseph, you know, later in Jesus' ministry, like Joseph, that a gracious and merciful application of the law that is
within the bounds of that law.
And completely in keeping with the tradition. But you're right, we see themes entering here in Matthew. These birth narratives are not to be easily skipped over as children's stories or anything like that, because we're seeing really deep theological themes introduced here in the retelling of these, you know, miraculous birth and virgin birth stories.
As one of our teachers told us, it's theological, not gynecological.
Yes. Any last words? What else would we want to preach or leave people with as we look at this last Sunday of Advent, knowing Christmas is only a few days away?
I think for a preacher, it's important to acknowledge the difficulties with the virgin birth. And I think it's helpful for congregations for that to be addressed head on.
Okay.
But I think the gift to both the preacher and the congregation is this promise that God is with us even in the midst of these mysteries. And just hold lightly to the mystery of it and sit with it and accept the joyful truth that God is with us as we grapple with the detail of this story.
And perhaps the gift of Matthew being on this fourth Advent instead of Christmas Day is actually that you can do that virgin birth kind of teaching in the congregation, maybe without getting into the nuts and bolts of that on Christmas Day when you might have a wider audience.
Like you try not to get into the nuts and bolts too much of Easter Sunday. Explaining the resurrection is not preaching the resurrection.
No,
that's right. Just as explaining the virgin birth is not the same as preaching the good news of God with us, Emmanuel, in our presence.
We've touched on quite a number of areas preachers could focus on in Advent 4, what's specific to Matthew and what's unique about his focus on Joseph and his use of Isaiah.
And if you're looking for an image of this story, it's quite hard to find. There's lots of angels visiting Mary and telling her about this miraculous pregnancy. Not so many of the angel visiting Joseph, but there is one on the Vanderbilt Divinity site by George Latour. It's a 17th century painting and it's quite beautiful, so you might like to have a look at that.
We've mentioned a few resources in the podcast today. Earlier I referred to Ben Meyer's book. Just a reminder, it's The Apostles' Creed, A Guide to the Ancient Catechism, and it is actually a great book to use in a congregational study group context as well. And details of these resources will be on our show notes on the website.
Well, thank you all for listening, and thank you so much, Rachel Kronberger, for being with us today. It's been wonderful to have your wisdom and insights on these texts. You've been listening to By the Well. This podcast has been made with the support of Pilgrim Theological College in Melbourne, the Uniting Church in Australia, and the technical genius of Adrian Jackson. You can subscribe to our podcast wherever you find your podcasts. Please rate, share, and visit our website, bythewell.com.au, for more information.